Confessions of a Spamking by Jack Hitt. 1. Meet the spammer. Click here, says my spamming mentor. Hovering over my chair, he points to the computer screen. Now click on that file of email addresses there. I have been invited by a master for an education in spamming. The practice of blasting millions of unsolicited email messages into the internet in order to advertise everything from loans with easy terms to women of easy virtue. Let's go online and download some software, says my guide. His name is Richard Colbert. On the ROXO, or Register of Known Spam Operations, a kind of most wanted list for the internet posted on an anti-spam website called spamhouse.org, Colbert has described plainly, non-stop scam spammer, kicked off so many hosts and ISPs, or internet service providers, it's hard to count. Dressed in blue shorts and a purple t-shirt, Colbert, 31, has blondish hair stuffed under a baseball cap, a prominent diamond earring, and a mild twang that betrays his Atlanta origin. He lights up the Monarch menthol as he shows me his computer room, an intimate homemade space built off the site of an aging two-tone mobile home, Robin's Egg Blue and White, which sits among hundreds of Airstreams and Miami Deco single wides in the Sunset Colony Mobile Home Park in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Colbert claims that he's now on a sabbatical from spamming, but he's watching current events and weighing a return. During this interlude, he has agreed to help me learn how the avalanche of solicitations I receive winds up in my online mailbox every day. Who are these guys? Who hires them? How do they get legitimate email addresses? And finally, can federal legislation currently under consideration actually stop them? First off, Colbert doesn't think about spam the way I do, or, most probably, the way you do. He likes to call it bulk emailing, for starters. And he considers it just one of the many exciting new markets available on the internet. He's the kind of guy who is always interrupting himself to tell you about some smart economic angle he has figured out, some new edge. These shorts are Dockers, he says, pointing at the clothes he has on. And I got them off eBay. Shirt. Tommy Hilfiger. eBay. Shoes. Nikes. eBay. Colbert and I dig around on the internet until, under his direction, I find a piece of software that allows for mass emailing. These are common and legal, used legitimately by professional archaeologists, say, or chess enthusiasts, to form an online group and conduct chats or exchange information. Right away there's a problem. The software we've selected requires registration or payment. But Colbert says he once used this very piece of software, slightly altered, when he worked with some other spammers who live nearby. So he snatches his phone and calls a neighbor for support. A minute later, we are back in business. It turns out that an unusually large number of spammers live in this area, the stretch of beaches north of Miami, that old-timers loosely call Boca, and new-timers know as a staging ground for the smarmier characters in Carl Hansen's novels. According to Steve Linford, who maintains the ROXO list, there's a good reason that so many spammers wind up on Spam Beach. Boca Raton is where they used to run those pump and dump investment scams, and where the telemarketing sweatshops are. The phone scammers and infomercial wannabes of the 80s and 90s who themselves supplanted the land speculators who established Florida's earliest cities upon shifting sand and sinking swamps have been pushed aside by the new boys on the block, the bulk emailers of the internet. 2. A spamming primer. How does a spammer obtain a million working email addresses? Most simply, there are lists you can buy off the internet. But there are also other, cheaper, ways. A dictionary attack, Colbert instructs, is when you blast reams of computer-generated potential email names, rne1@hotmail.com, rne2@hotmail.com, rne3@hotmail.com, and see which ones stick. Another good tool is called a spider, a software program that can crawl through web pages, looking for that telltale symbol, at. Then it simply records everything to the left and right of it, and bingo, it has a good email address. A good method for avoiding spam, then, is to always type your email address on the web this way, arnie@hotmail.com or arnaramavethis@hotmail.com. Humans can look at either and figure out what to do. Software so far is helpless. Sitting at Richard's computer, I set out to launch my first spam. I append a file of email addresses to the software along with my cover letter, my spam. To keep everything vaguely legal, my spam is nothing more than a cheerful holiday greeting. At the end of which is a link to Baoyelp.com, one of Colbert's websites. The software starts firing, and my notes ricochet through cyberspace. The software monitors which emails are returned, and tabulates their status. When an out-of-the-office auto-reply comes back on one email message, Colbert says, "Oh, we love those." They confirm that the address is active. Within 6 minutes, on a single computer, running through a regular phone line, I have fired off 1,000 email messages. Which is one of the attractive things about spam for spammers. You don't have to leave your mobile home to do it. There's no door-to-door soliciting for clients, no annual conferences to attend. The business is all neatly contained on your desktop. For instance, how does a spammer find clients willing to hire him? He spams. Colbert used to find clients by trolling through AOL's member directory. Many of AOL's 35 million members fill out helpful online profiles when they join, listing their interests and activities. Colbert used those profiles to turn AOL into a rich and easy source of contacts. He would limit his search by typing in business opportunity or multi-level marketing in order to find the sort of small-time sales folks who might be receptive to his offer, then he would spam them all with his pitch. I might get 100 responses from 100,000 emails, Colbert says. He would write back personally to those asking for the text of the ad they wanted to spam out and relaying his pricing structure, $300, to send out 100,000 messages. Or $900 for a million. From the 100 people who would agree to hear his personal pitch, he would usually land between 2 and 5 contracts. Although this might seem like a pitiful response rate, 1/500th of 1% is ruinous in any other market. This one search for spam clients could yield Colbert as much as $14,000. Colbert describes how he would set his computers for send with millions of email messages queued up, then go to sleep and let the machinery make the money for him. I used to have 9 computers bound over 5 DSL lines on a 10 meg pipe feeding 500k per second per computer, Colbert says. That's 1 million emails an hour per computer, 9 million an hour on a good day. His clients were usually small-scale entrepreneurs or website hosts who worked the margins of the online economy, herbal supplements, and cut-rate financial services. Sometimes he would be hired to spam for larger, more reputable companies, not that he would name any for me, but he did admit that he would try to use the cleanest list possible in those cases to keep down the tsunami of complaints that a company typically receives with each spam blast. Payment to Colbert was strictly old school. I didn't ever take credit cards, he says. He would insist on being paid by money order or check. He explains the risk of credit card payment. If the clients didn't get the response they wanted, they'd frequently charge back the fee. The majority of spammers are paid a flat fee, Colbert says, and those fees have been dropping. Only 5 years ago, the top tier of spammers was building online marketing companies and selling them for astonishing sums in the millions of dollars. In those heady days, spam enjoyed the same inflated finances as tech stocks. But even after the bubble burst, spam was handsomely profitable. I cleared $130,000 in 2 months, Colbert says, the best money I've ever made. As more players enter the market, though, the profits are thinning. These days I've seen spam offered as low as $25 for 1 million addresses, Colbert grouses. There's still money in it, but it's a lot more work for a lot less. 3. The new spam. Ever since the Federal Trade Commission earlier this year held a spam conference which brought together spam recipients, Congress, anti-spammers, and the spammers themselves, a metaphysical question has emerged: is there such a thing as good spam versus bad? Colbert thinks so, and his reasoning has led him to a solution that he predicts will make everyone happy. He recently wrote a letter to both of his senators outlining his thoughts. He said that the only way to stop the bad spamming, the scams, the deceptive links, the anonymous porn mailings is to sanction a legitimate form of commercial spam with established standards. These might include accurate and functional front lines, so that when you click reply to a piece of commercial email you would actually be able to contact the person who sent it. Front lines on most spam email messages are frauds routed through various computers in order to give the spammer a cloak of invisibility. Also, each legitimate spam would have a real, working remove link, so that it would be easy for the recipient to take himself off spammers' lists. Then, according to Colbert's plan, legitimate spammers could drum up business, and spam cops would spend their time tracking the real outlaws. Another spammer I spoke with, Bill Wagoner, who operates out of Spam Beach West aka Las Vegas, drew the same distinction. "Spam is scam," said the part-time heavy metal musician and shortwave talk radio host, who was, according to Roxo, one of the top 10 spammers in the world. He claims that all his bulk email is clean, meaning that each one has a good return address, contains a working remove link, and sells legitimate goods and services. I couldn't resist pointing out to Wagoner that he has publicly admitted that he pushes an herbal penis enlargement pill. "That's not fraud," he said. "If it was fraud, the company wouldn't make any money." When I tried to pursue the suddenly slippery definition of fraud, he quickly added, defensively, "The only sex product I sell is the penis enlargement pill." This debate about good and evil isn't going on just among spammers. It is also currently underway in Congress. Some kind of spam law will probably emerge from Washington in the next year. And it will be the first test of populist digital legislation in Congress since the creation of the Internet. In the weeks leading up to the August recess, the spam fight in the House got pretty intense. There are two main competing bills, which basically track the two strands of this emerging philosophical argument. The leading one, written by Representative Richard Ember, Republican of North Carolina, and sponsored by two influential Republican representatives, F. James Sensenbrenner Jr. of Wisconsin and Billy Dawson of Louisiana, more or less codifies Colbert and Wagoner's view. As first written, the Burr bill was meant to outlaw only fraudulent spam in order to protect commerce on the Internet. From our point of view, we are trying to retain email as a legitimate form of commercial activity, one Burr staff member said. If you want to sell a product, you should be able to do that with email. But the public debate on spam is changing fast. Within a few weeks, the momentum moved away from the power brokers, like Sensenbrenner and Tawson, and toward less known representatives, whose proposals are tougher, mainly Heather A. Wilson, a Republican from New Mexico, and Jean Green, a Democrat from Texas. "The Burr bill approaches the problem from the point of view of commerce," Wilson observed delicately. "We approach it from a consumer perspective." A co-debate regarding spam turns on how you are allowed to say no to spam, a debate that boils down to the phrases opt-in and opt-out. Opt-in is the toughest. It requires that all bulk emailers get your permission before sending any spam. Opt-out allows spammers to flood your mailbox all they want, as long as each individual email message contains a link permitting you to stop all future spams from that one business. This summer, the opt-out provision was the one favored by most members of Congress, because it gave marketers and business the greatest leeway. But as the representatives sped toward their summer recess, and the levels of spam in their constituents' inbox spiked to record high levels, it suddenly seemed like opt-out was no longer acceptable. "We are at a tipping point," Wilson confessed. "We may have to get more radical in our solution." But according to Colbert, the tipping point for spam will always be just around the corner, because spammers are so good at figuring out the potential use or abuse of each new technological innovation. Colbert seems to enjoy recounting the many ways he made the tiniest changes in the system work for him. "I was thrown off more Bell South accounts than half the state of Florida," Colbert says. His name was known, and he was a marked and wanted man. But he found a way around the heat. Do you remember when American Express came out with temporary credit cards? Here it calls happily. You could go to the 7-Eleven convenience store and buy a $25 credit card, sort of like you buy a $25 phone card, only it was good for just $25 worth of credit. Armed with a dozen of these cards, Colbert would go to the Bell South website and create numerous email accounts from which to send spam, each account with a fictitious name and address. Since the credit card couldn't be connected to him in any way, he could spam away until Bell South finally got around to canceling that particular account. They were great, totally untraceable, he says of the credit cards. They don't sell them anymore. I think it's because of me. More recently, spammers have figured out how to send unwanted text messages to cell phones. And new wireless, or Wi-Fi, technology, Colbert tells me, is providing spammers with another potential cloak of invisibility. 4. Is there an answer? So what does a spammer, like Richard Colbert, fear? Going to jail or going broke? There's a difference, and in that difference is the key to the debate about stopping spam. Despite our ferociously partisan times, the Republicans and Democrats agree on this one thing: prosecuting spam should be the domain of a big Homeland Security-style federal bureaucracy. The only question is, should it be the Federal Trade Commission, or some other agency? Most of the anti-spammers prefer a solution known as private right of action, which would permit consumers to hunt down spammers and sue them for small damages, say $500, in a state district court. Just enough, goes the theory, to ruin the slim profit margin on spamming. Also known as distributive justice, it's the same idea that worked to stop junk faxes a decade ago, death by a thousand paper cuts, as Ted Gavin, treasurer of SpamCon, an anti-spam group, likes to call it. The debate is an old one. Which deters better? The widespread campaign of harassing a lot of mid-level operatives, or highly visible arrests of a few kingpins? Washington politicians tend to prefer the latter, because they bring immediate television coverage. In recent testimony before Congress, Orson Swindle, an FTC commissioner, stated this position plainly: we need a couple of good hangings here. Despite the threat of the noose, spammers yawn at the law enforcement approach, according to Colbert, for the simple reason that the police are slow, and the digital trail goes cold very fast. Most ISPs record the digital trail of each email message that passes through its system, but these mail server logs 2/3, as they are called, are routinely overwritten and erased. You have about 12 hours to track a person on the internet before the trail goes dead, Colbert says. Law enforcement is too slow. The anti-spammers, on the other hand, pose a different threat. A little-known secret about anti-spammers is that many of them are fairly renowned hackers, Colbert says. They track spammers in ways that the FTC can't. But the distributive justice approach is all but dead in Congress, at least in part because of the Republicans' deep antipathy for trial lawyers. It's not on the table, said a Democratic staff member on the Commerce Committee. Wilson told me that private right of action was not such a bad idea, and was interesting to talk about in an intellectual way. But I also want to get a bill passed in the House, she confessed. Back in Colbert's mobile home, I ask my spammer guru if he is feeling nervous now that Congress is in the market for a few high-profile public hangings. Doesn't he fear that Orson Swindle might soon have him in an orange jumpsuit and shackles, doing a primetime PERP walk? Congress is full of idiots, he notes succinctly. Colbert says he doesn't believe that a strategy of going after a few kingpins will accomplish anything. Politicians will gain some publicity, but in the process, he argues, they will drive smaller operators further underground. Spammers will just use even more deceptive practices to keep from getting shut down, he says. So is he getting back in business? Colbert remains cagey with a direct answer, but then sidles over to a file cabinet. He pulls out a CD and twirls it among his fingertips. The CD has 200 million email addresses on it, he tells me, sounding like a man eager to once again hit send. I ask him about his old system, the 9 hard drives bound together with a super fast connection speed that could pump out millions of email messages in an hour, and whether the coming laws make him too nervous to spend money rebuilding his infrastructure. Colbert seems amused by my assumptions regarding his expenses. As the late afternoon sky turns Boca gold, he fires up another menthol and takes a big, nourish puff. He points under his desk to a recent arrival, a second hard drive, precisely what he would need to begin a new network. It's a Dell Pentium 233, he says. I got it for $15, plus $23.95 shipping. A cloud of smoke fills the side room of the single wide. Ebay, he says with a smile. Jack Hitt is a contributing writer for the magazine.